This is Audible.
For Tabby.
Where do you go when you're lonely? Where do you go when you're blue? Where do you go when you're lonely? I'll follow you when the stars go blue.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Lisi's Story by Stephen King. Read by Mayor Winningham, with an afterword by the author.
Baby. Baby love. Part 1. Bool Hunt. If I were the moon, I know where I would fall down. D.H. Lawrence, The Rainbow. Chapter 1. Lisi and Amanda. Everything the same. 1. To the public eye, the spouses of well-known writers are all but invisible, and no one knew it better than Lisi Landon. Her husband had won the Pulitzer and the National Book Award, but Lisi had given only one interview in her life. This was for the well-known women's magazine that publishes the column, "Yes, I'm Married to Him." She spent roughly half of its 500-word length explaining that her nickname rhymed with Cece. Most of the other half had to do with her recipe for slow-cooked roast beef. Lisi's sister Amanda said that the picture accompanying the interview made Lisi look fat. None of Lisi's sisters was immune to the pleasures of setting the cat among the pigeons. Stirring up a stink had been their father's phrase for it, or having a good natter about someone else's dirty laundry. But the only one Lisi had a hard time liking was this same Amanda. Eldest and oddest of the one-time Debusschere girls of Lisbon Falls, Amanda currently lived alone, in a house which Lisi had provided, a small, weathertight place not too far from Castleview, where Lisi, Darla, and Cantata could keep an eye on her. Lisi had bought it for her 7 years ago, 5 before Scott died. Died young. Died before his time, as the saying was. Lisi still had trouble believing he'd been gone for 2 years. It seemed both longer and the blink of an eye. When Lisi finally got around to making a start at cleaning out his office suite, a long and beautifully lit series of rooms that had once been no more than the loft above a country barn, Amanda had shown up on the third day, after Lisi had finished her inventory of all the foreign editions, there were hundreds, but before she could do more than start listing the furniture, with little stars next to the pieces she thought she ought to keep. She waited for Amanda to ask her why she wasn't moving faster, for heaven's sake. But Amanda asked no questions. While Lisi moved from the furniture question to a listless and day-long consideration of the cardboard boxes of correspondence stacked in the main closet, Amanda's focus seemed to remain on the impressive stacks and piles of memorabilia which ran the length of the study's south wall. She worked her way back and forth along this snake-like accretion, saying little or nothing, but jotting frequently in a little notebook she kept near to hand. What Lisi didn't say was, "What are you looking for? Or what are you writing down?" As Scott had pointed out on more than one occasion, Lisi had what was surely among the rarest of human talents. She was a business-minder who did not mind too much if you didn't mind yours. As long as you weren't making explosives to throw at somebody, that was. And in Amanda's case, explosives were always a possibility. She was the sort of woman who couldn't help prying. The sort of woman who would open her mouth sooner or later. Her husband had headed south from Rumford, where they had been living, like a couple of wolverines caught in a drainpipe, Scott said after an afternoon visit he vowed never to repeat, in 1985. Her one child, named Intermezzo and called Metzi for short, had gone north to Canada, with a long-haul trucker for a beau, in 1989. One flew north. One flew south, one couldn't shut her everlasting mouth. That had been their father's rhyme when they were kids. and the one of Dandy Dave DeBusschere's girls who never could shut her everlasting mouth was Shirley Manda, dumped first by her husband and then by her own daughter. Hard to like as Amanda sometimes was, Lisi hadn't wanted her down there in Rumford on her own. Didn't trust her on her own, if it came to that. And although they'd never said so aloud, Lisi was sure Darla and Cantata felt the same. So she'd had a talk with Scott and found the little Cape Cod, which could be had for $97,000 cash on the nail. Amanda had moved up within easy checking range soon after. Now Scott was dead, and Lisi had finally gotten around to the business of cleaning out his writing quarters. Halfway through the fourth day, the foreign editions were boxed up, the correspondence was marked and in some sort of order, and she had a good idea of what furniture was going and what was staying. So why did it feel like she had done so little? She'd known from the outset that this was a job which couldn't be hurried. Never mind all the importuning letters and phone calls she'd gotten since Scott's death, and more than a few visits, too. She supposed that in the end, the people who were interested in Scott's unpublished writing would get what they wanted, but not until she was ready to give it to them. They hadn't been clear on that at first. They weren't down with it, as the saying was. Now she thought most of them were. There were lots of words for the stuff Scott had left behind. The only one she completely understood was memorabilia, but there was another one, a funny one, that sounded like incunkabilla. That was what the impatient people wanted, the wheedlers and the angry ones. Scott's incunkabilla. Lisi began to think of them as incunks. 2. What she felt most of all, especially after Amanda showed up, was discouraged, as if she'd either underestimated the task itself or overestimated, wildly, her ability to see it through to its inevitable conclusion. The saved furniture stored in the barn below, the rugs rolled up and taped shut, the yellow rider van in the driveway, throwing its shadow on the board fence between her yard and the Galloways next door. Oh, and don't forget the sad heart of this place, the 3 desktop computers. There had been 4, but the one in the memory nook was now gone, thanks to Lisi herself. Each was newer and lighter than the last, but even the newest was a big desktop model, and all of them still worked. They were password-protected, too, and she didn't know what the passwords were. She'd never asked, and had no idea what kind of electro-litter might be sleeping on the computer's hard drives. Grocery lists? Poems? Erotica? She was sure he'd been connected to the Internet, but had no idea where he visited when he was there. Amazon? Drudge? Hank Williams Lives? Madame Cruella's Golden Showers and Tower of Power? She tended to think not anything like that last, to think she would have seen the bills, or at least divots in the monthly house money account. Except, of course, that was really bullshit. If Scott had wanted to hide $1,000 a month from her, he could have done so. And the passwords? The joke was he might have told her. She forgot stuff like that, that was all. She reminded herself to try her own name. Maybe after Amanda had taken herself home for the day, which didn't look like happening any time soon. Lisi sat back and blew hair off her forehead. I won't get to the manuscripts until July at this rate, she thought. The incunks would go nuts if they saw the way I'm crawling along, especially that last one. The last one, 5 months ago this had been, had managed not to blow up, had managed to keep a very civil tongue about him until she'd begun to think he might be different. Lisi told him that Scott's writing suite had been sitting empty for almost 1.5 years at that time, but she'd almost mustered the energy and resolve to go up there and start the work of cleaning the rooms and setting the place to rights. Her visitor's name had been Professor Joseph Woodbody, of the University of Pittsburgh English Department. Pitt was Scott's alma mater, and Woodbody's Scott Landon and the American Myth lecture class was extremely popular and extremely large. He also had 4 graduate students doing Scott Landon theses this year, and so it was probably inevitable that the incunk warrior would come to the fore when Lisi spoke in such vague terms as sooner rather than later, and almost certainly sometime this summer. But it wasn't until she assured him that she would give him a call when the dust settles that Woodbody really began to give way. He said that the fact that she had shared a great American writer's bed did not qualify her to serve as his literary executor. That, he said, was a job for an expert, and he understood that Mrs. Landon had no college degree at all. He reminded her of the time already gone since Scott Landon's death, and of the rumors that continued to grow. Supposedly there were piles of unpublished Landon fiction, short stories, even novels. Could she not let him into the study for even a little while? Let him prospect a bit in the file cabinets and desk drawers, if only to set the most outrageous rumors to rest? She could stay with him the whole time, of course, that went without saying. "No," she'd said, showing Professor Woodbody to the door. "I'm not ready just yet." Overlooking the man's lower blows, trying to at least, because he was obviously as crazy as the rest of them. He just hidden it better, and for a little longer. "And when I am, I'll want to look at everything, not just the manuscripts." "But," she had nodded seriously to him, "everything the same." "I don't understand what you mean by that." Of course he didn't. It had been part of her marriage's inner language. How many times had Scott come breezing in, calling, "Hey, Lisey, I'm home. Everything the same?" Meaning, "Is everything all right? Is everything cool?" But like most phrases of power, Scott had explained this once to her, but Lisey had already known it. It had an inside meaning. A man like Woodbody could never grasp the inside meaning of everything the same. Lisey could explain it all day and he still wouldn't get it. Why? Because he was an incunk. And when it came to Scott Landon, only one thing interested the incunks. "It doesn't matter," was what she'd said to Professor Woodbody on that day 5 months ago. Scott would have understood. 3. If Amanda had asked Lisey where Scott's memory nook things had been stored, the awards and plaques, stuff like that, Lisey would have lied, a thing she did tolerably well for one who did it seldom, and said, "You store it in Mechanic Falls." Amanda did not ask, however. She just paged ever more ostentatiously through her little notebook, surely trying to get her younger sister to broach the subject with the proper question. But Lisey did not ask. She was thinking of how empty this corner was. How empty and uninteresting, with so many of Scott's mementos gone. Either destroyed, like the computer monitor, or too badly scratched and dented to be shown. Such an exhibit would raise more questions than it could ever answer. At last Amanda gave in and opened her notebook. "Look at this," she said. "Just look." Amanda was holding out the first page. Written on the blue lines, crammed in from the little wire loops on the left to the edge of the sheet on the right, like a coded message from one of those street crazies you're always running into in New York because there's not enough money for the publicly funded mental institutions anymore, Lisey thought wearily, were numbers. Most had been circled. A very few had been enclosed in squares. Amanda turned the page, and now here were two pages filled with more of the same. On the following page, the numbers stopped halfway down. The final one appeared to be 846. Amanda gave her the sidelong, red-cheeked, and somehow hilarious expression of hauteur that had meant, when she was 12 and little Lisey only 2, that Amanda had gone and taken something on herself. Tears for someone would follow. Amanda herself, more often than not. Lisey found herself waiting with some interest and a touch of dread to see what that expression might mean this time. Amanda had been acting nutty ever since turning up. Maybe it was just the sullen, sultry weather. More likely it had to do with the sudden absence of her longtime boyfriend. If Amanda was headed for another spell of stormy emotional weather because Charlie Corriveau had jilted her, then Lisey supposed she had better buckle up herself. She had never liked or trusted Corriveau, banker or not. How could you trust a man, after overhearing at the spring library bake sale, that the guys down at the Mellow Tiger called him Shootin' Beans? What kind of a nickname was that for a banker? What did it even mean? And surely he had to know that Amanda had mental problems in the past. "Lisey?" Amanda asked. Her brow was deeply furrowed. "I'm sorry," Lisey said. "I just kind of went off there for a second." "You often do," Amanda said. "I think you got it from Scott. Pay attention, Lisey. I made a little number on each of his magazines and journals and scholarly things. The ones piled over there against the wall." Lisi nodded as if she understood where this was going. I made the numbers in pencil, just light, Amanda went on. Always when your back was turned or when you were somewhere else. Because I thought if you saw, you might have told me to stop.
I wouldn't have.
She took the little notebook, which was limp with its owner's sweat.
846? That many.
And she knew the publications running along the wall weren't the sort she herself might read and have in the house, ones like O and Good Housekeeping and Ms., but rather Little Sewanee Review and Glimmer Train and Open City and things with incomprehensible names like Piskya.
Quite a few more than that, Amanda said, and cocked a thumb at the piles of books and journals.
When Lisi really looked at them, she saw that her sister was right. Many more than 840-some. Had to be.
Almost 3,000 in all, and where you'll put them, and who'd want them, I'm sure I can't say. No, 846 is just the number that have pictures of you.
This was so awkwardly stated that Lisi at first didn't understand it. When she did, she was delighted. The idea that there might be such an unexpected photo resource, such a hidden record of her time with Scott, had never crossed her mind. And when she thought about it, it made perfect sense. They had been married over 25 years at the time of his death, and Scott had been an inveterate, restless traveler during those years, reading, lecturing, crisscrossing the country with hardly a pause when he was between books, visiting as many as 90 campuses a year and never losing a beat in his seemingly endless stream of short stories. And on most of those rambles, she was with him. In how many motels had she taken the little Swedish steamer to one of his suites, while the TV muttered talk show psalms on her side of the room, and on his the portable typewriter clacked early in the marriage, or the laptop clicked quietly late, as he sat looking down at it with a comma of hair falling on his brow. Amanda was looking at her sourly, clearly not liking her reaction so far. The ones that are circled, over 600 of them, are ones where you've been treated discourteously in the photo caption.
Is that so?
Lisi was mystified.
I'll show you.
Amanda studied the notebook, went over to the slumbering wall-length stack, consulted again, and selected two items. One was an expensive-looking hardcover biannual from the University of Kentucky at Bowling Green. The other, a digest-sized magazine that looked like a student effort, was called Pushpelt, one of those names designed by English majors to be charming and mean absolutely nothing.
Open them, Amanda commanded, and as she shoved them into her hands, Lisi smelled the wild and acrid bouquet of her sister's sweat. The pages are marked with little scrids of paper, see?
Scrids. Their mother's word for scraps. Lisi opened the biannual first, turning to the marked page. The picture of her and Scott in that one was very good, very smoothly printed. Scott was approaching a podium while she stood behind him clapping. The audience stood below, also clapping. The picture of them in Pushpelt was nowhere near as smooth. The dots in the dot matrix looked as big as the points of pencils with mushed leads, and there were hunks of wood floating in the pulp paper. But she looked at it and felt like crying. Scott was entering some dark cellar full of noise. There was a big old Scott grin on his face that said, oh yeah, this be the place. She was a step or two behind him, her own smile visible in the back kick of what must have been a mighty flash. She could even make out the blouse she was wearing, that blue Anne Klein with the funny single red stripe down the left side. What she had on below was lost in shadow, and she couldn't remember this particular evening at all, but she knew it had been jeans. When she went out late, she always put on a pair of faded jeans. The caption read, Living legend Scott Landon, accompanied by Gal Pal, makes an appearance at the University of Vermont's Stalag 17 Club last month. Landon stayed until last call, reading, dancing, partying. Man knows how to get down.
Yes, man had known how to get down, she could testify.
She looked at all the other periodicals, was suddenly overwhelmed by the riches she might find in them, and realized Amanda had hurt her after all, had gored her a wound that might bleed a long time. Was he the only one who had known about the dark places? The dirty dark ones where you were so alone and wretchedly voiceless? Maybe she didn't know all that he had, but she knew enough. Certainly she knew he had been haunted and would never look into a mirror, any reflective surface if he could help it, after the sun went down. And she had loved him in spite of all that, because the man had known how to get down. But no more. Now the man was down. The man had passed on, as the saying was. Her life had moved on to a new phase, a solo phase, and it was too late to turn back now. The phrase gave her a shudder and made her think of things. The purple, the thing with the piebald side. Best not thought of, and so she turned her mind away from them. "I'm glad you found these pictures," she told Amanda warmly. "You're a pretty good big sister, you know it?" And, as Lisi had hoped, but not really dared expect, Amanda was startled right out of her haughty, skittish little dance. She looked uncertainly at Lisi, seeming to hunt for insincerity and finding none. Little by little, she relaxed into a biddable, easier-to-cope-with Amanda. She took back the notebook and looked at it with a frown, as if not entirely sure where it had come from. Lisi thought, considering the obsessive nature of the numbers, that this might be a big step in a good direction. Then Amanda nodded as people do when they recall something that should not have been lost to mind in the first place. "In the ones not circled, you're at least named. Lisa Landon, an actual person. Last of all, but hardly least. Considering what we've always called you, that's almost a pun, isn't it? You'll see that a few of the numbers have squares around them. Those are pictures of you alone." She gave Lisi an impressive, almost forbidding look. "You'll want to have a look at them." "I'm sure." Trying to sound thrilled out of her underpants when she was unable to think why she'd have any slightest interest in pictures of herself alone during those all too brief years when she'd had a man. A good man. A non-incunk. Who knew how to strap it on. With whom to share her days and nights. She raised her eyes to the untidy heaps and foothills of periodicals which came in every size and shape, imagining what it would be like to go through them stack by stack and one by one, sitting cross-legged on the floor of the memory nook, where else, hunting out those images of her and Scott. And in the ones that had made Amanda so angry, she would always find herself walking a little behind him, looking up at him. If others were applauding, she would be applauding too. Her face would be smooth, giving away little, showing nothing but polite attention. Her face said, "He does not bore me." Her face said, "He does not exalt me." Her face said, "I do not set myself on fire for him, nor he for me." The lie, the lie, the lie. Her face said, "Everything the same." Amanda hated these pictures. She looked and saw her sister playing salt for the sirloin, setting for the stone. She saw her sister sometimes identified as Mrs. Landon, sometimes as Mrs. Scott Landon, and sometimes, oh, this was bitter, not identified at all. Demoted all the way to gal pal. To Amanda, it must seem like a kind of murder. "Mandio?" Amanda looked at her. The light was cruel, and Lisi remembered with a real and total sense of shock that Amanda would be 60 in the fall. 60. In that moment, Lisi found herself thinking about the thing that had haunted her husband on so many sleepless nights. The thing the wood bodies of the world would never know about. Not if she had her way. Something with an endless, mottled side. Something seen best by cancer patients looking into tumblers from which all the painkiller had been emptied. There will be no more until morning. "It's very close, honey. I can't see it, but I can hear it taking its meal."
"Shut up, Scott. I don't know what you're talking about."
"Lisi?" Amanda asked. "Did you say something?"
"Just muttering under my breath." She tried to smile.
"Were you talking to Scott?"
Lisi gave up trying to smile.
"Yes, I guess I was. Sometimes I still do."
"Crazy, huh?"
"I don't think so. Not if it works. I think crazy is what doesn't work, and I ought to know. I've had some experience, right?"
"Amanda." But Amanda had turned to look at the heaps of journals and annuals and student magazines. When she returned her gaze to Lisi, she was smiling uncertainly.
"Did I do right, Lisi? I only wanted to do my part."
Lisi took one of Amanda's hands and squeezed it lightly.
"You did. What do you say we get out of here? I'll flip you for the first shower."
4. "I was lost in the dark and you found me. I was hot, so hot, and you gave me ice. Scott's voice. Lisi opened her eyes, thinking she had drifted away from some daytime task or moment and had had a brief but amazingly detailed dream in which Scott was dead, and she was engaged in the Herculean job of cleaning out his riding stables. With them open, she immediately understood that Scott indeed was dead. She was asleep in her own bed after delivering Manda home, and this was her dream. She seemed to be floating in moonlight. She could smell exotic flowers. A fine-grained summer wind combed her hair back from her temples, the kind of wind that blows long after midnight in some secret place far from home. Yet it was home, had to be home, because ahead of her was the barn which housed Scott's riding suite, object of so much incunk interest. And now, thanks to Amanda, she knew it held all those pictures of her and her late husband. All that buried treasure, that emotional loot. It might be better not to look at those pictures, the wind whispered in her ears. Oh, of that she had no doubt, but she would look, was helpless not to, now that she knew they were there. She was delighted to see she was floating on a vast, moon-gilded piece of cloth with the words Pillsbury's Best Flower printed across it again and again. The corners had been knotted like hankies. She was charmed by the whimsy of it. It was like floating on a cloud. Scott. She tried to say his name aloud and could not. The dream wouldn't let her. The driveway leading to the barn was gone, she saw. So was the yard between it and the house. Where they had been was a vast field of purple flowers, dreaming in haunted moonlight. Scott, I loved you. I saved you. I... 5. Then she was awake and could hear herself in the dark saying it over and over like a mantra. I loved you. I saved you. I got you ice. I loved you. I saved you. I got you ice. I loved you. I saved you. I got you ice. She lay there a long time, remembering a hot August day in Nashville, and thinking, not for the first time, that being single after being double so long was strange shite indeed. She would have thought 2 years was enough time for the strangeness to rub off, but it wasn't. Time apparently did nothing but blunt grief's sharpest edge so that it hacked rather than sliced. Because everything was not the same. Not outside, not inside, not for her. Lying in the bed that had once held two, Lisi thought alone never felt more lonely than when you woke up and discovered you still had the house to yourself. That you and the mice in the walls were the only ones still breathing. Chapter 2. Lisi and the Madman. Darkness loves him. 1. The next morning, Lisi sat tailor fashion on the floor of Scott's memory nook, looking across at the heaps and stacks and piles of magazines, alumni reports, English department bulletins, and university journals that ran along the study's south wall. It had occurred to her that maybe looking would be enough to dispel the stealthy hold all those as yet unseen pictures had taken on her imagination. Now that she was actually here, she knew that had been a vain hope. Nor would she need Manda's limp little notebook with all the numbers in it. That was lying discarded on the floor nearby, and Lisi put it in the back pocket of her jeans. She didn't like the look of it, the treasured artifact of a not-quite-right mind. She once again measured that long stack of books and magazines against the south wall, a dusty book snake 4 feet high and easily 30 feet long. If not for Amanda, she probably would have packed every last one of them away in liquor store boxes without ever looking at them or wondering what Scott meant by keeping so many of them. My mind just doesn't run that way, she told herself. I'm really not much of a thinker at all. Maybe not, but you always remembered like a champ. That was Scott at his most teasing, charming, and hard to resist. But the truth was, she'd been better at forgetting. As had he. And both of them had had their reasons. And yet, as if to prove his point, she heard a ghostly snatch of conversation. One speaker, Scott, was familiar. The other voice had a little southern glide to it. A pretentious little southern glide, maybe. Tony here will be writing it up for the thingamy rum tum tummy whatever. Would you like to see a copy, Mr. Landon? Hmm? Sure, you bet.
Muttering voices all around them. Scott barely hearing the thing about Tony writing it up. He'd had what was almost a politician's knack for turning himself outward to those who'd come to see him when he was in public. Scott was listening to the voices of the swelling crowd and already thinking about finding the plug-in point. That pleasurable moment when the electricity flowed from him to them and then back to him again, doubled or even tripled. He'd loved the current, but Lisi was convinced he had loved the instant of plugging in even more. Still, he'd taken time to respond.
You can send photos, campus newspaper articles or reviews, departmental write-ups, anything like that. Please. I like to see everything.
The study, RFD number 2, Sugar Top Hill Road, Castle Rock, Maine. Lisi knows the zip. I always forget.
Nothing else about her, just Lisi knows the zip. How Amanda would have howled to hear it. But she had wanted to be forgotten on those trips, both there and not there. She liked to watch.
Like the fellow in the porno movie? Scott had asked her once, and she'd returned the thin moon smile that told him he was treading near the edge.
If you say so, dear, she had replied.
He always introduced her when they arrived and again here and there to other people when it became necessary, but it rarely did. Outside of their own fields, academics were oddly lacking in curiosity. Most of them were just delighted to have the author of The Coaster's Daughter, National Book Award, and Relics, the Pulitzer, among them. Also, there had been a period of about 10 years when Scott had somehow gotten larger than life, to others and sometimes to himself. Not to Lisi. She was the one who had to fetch him a fresh roll of toilet paper when he ran out while he was on the john. Nobody exactly charged the stage when he stood there with the microphone in his hand, but even Lisi felt the connection he made with his audience, those volts. It was hardwired, and it had little to do with his work as a writer, maybe nothing. It had to do with the Scottness of him, somehow. That sounded crazy, but it was true. And it never seemed to change him much or hurt him, at least until... Her eyes stopped moving, fixed on a hardcover spine and gold-leaf letters reading, U10 Nashville, 1988 Review. 1988, the year of the rockabilly novel, the one he'd never written. 1988, the year of the madman.
Tony here would be writing it up.
No, Lisi said, wrong. He didn't say Tony. He said...
Tony?
Yes, that was right. He said, Tony.
He said, Tony here would be writing it up.
Writing it up for the U10 88 year in review, Lisi said. He said...
I could express mail it.
Only she was damned if the little Tennessee Williams wannabe hadn't almost said, express mail it. That was the voice, all right. That was the Southern fried chicken shit.
Dashmore? Dashman?
The man had dashed all right. Had dashed like a smuckin' track star, but that wasn't it. It had been... Dashmeal, Lisi murmured to the empty rooms and clenched her fists. She stared at the book with the gold-stamped spine as if it might disappear the second she took her eyes away.
Little prig Southerner's name was Dashmeal, and he ran like a rabbit.
Scott would have turned down the offer of Express Mail or Federal Express, believed such things to be a needless expense. About correspondence, there was never any hurry. When it came floating downstream, he plucked it out. When it came to reviews of his novels, he had been a lot less, come back to the raft, Huck, honey, and a lot more, what makes Scotty run? But for write-ups following public appearances, regular mail did him just fine. Since the study had its own address, Lisi realized she would have been very unlikely to see these things when they came in. And once they were here, well, these airy, well-lighted rooms had been Scott's creative playground, not hers. A mostly benign one-boy clubhouse where he'd written his stories and listened to his music as loud as he wanted in the soundproofed area he called my padded cell. There'd never been a keep-out sign on the door. She'd been up here lots of times when he was alive, and Scott was always glad to see her. But it had taken Amanda to see what was in the belly of the book snake sleeping against the south wall. Quick to offense Amanda, suspicious Amanda, OCD Amanda, who had somehow become convinced that her house would burn flat if she didn't load the kitchen stove with exactly 3 maple chunks at a time, no more or less. Amanda, whose unalterable habit was to turn around 3 times on her stoop if she had to go back into the house for something she'd forgotten. Look at stuff like that, or listen to her counting strokes as she brushed her teeth,
and you could easily write Manda off as just another gonzo bonky old maid. Somebody write that lady a prescription for Zoloft or Prozac. But without Manda, does little Lisi ever realize there are hundreds of pictures of her dead husband up here, just waiting for her to look at them? Hundreds of memories waiting to be called forth? And most of them surely more pleasant than the memory of Dashmeal, that southern fried chicken shit coward. "Stop it," she murmured. "Just stop it now. Lisa de Pusher-Landon, you open your hand and let that go." But she was apparently not ready to do that, because she got up, crossed the room, and knelt before the books. Her right hand floated out ahead of her, like a magician's trick, and grasped the volume marked U-10 Nashville 1988 Review. Her heart was pounding hard, not with excitement, but with fear. The head could tell the heart all that was 18 years over, but in matters of emotion, the heart had its own brilliant vocabulary. The madman's hair had been so blonde, it was almost white. He had been a graduate student madman, spouting what was not quite gibberish. A day after the shooting, when Scott's condition was upgraded from critical to fair, she had asked Scott if the madman grad student had had it strapped on, and Scott had whispered that he didn't know if a crazy person could strap anything on. Strapping it on was a heroic act, an act of will, and crazy people didn't have much in the way of will. Or did she think otherwise? "I don't know, Scott. I'll think about it." Not meaning to, wanting to never think about it again, if she could help it. As far as Lisi was concerned, the smucking Looney Tune with the little gun could join the other things she'd successively forgotten since meeting Scott.
Hot, wasn't it?
Lying in bed, still pale, far too pale, but starting to get a little of his color back. Casual, no special look, just making conversation. And Lisi now, Lisi alone, the Widow Landon, shivered. "He didn't remember," she murmured. She was almost positive he didn't. Nothing about when he'd been down on the pavement and they'd both been sure he would never get back up, that he was dying, and whatever passed between them was all there would ever be, they who had found so much to say to each other. The neurologist she plucked up courage enough to speak to said that forgetting around the time of a traumatic event was par for the course, that people recovering from such events often discovered that a spot had been burned black in the film of their memories. That spot might stretch over 5 minutes, 5 hours, or 5 days. Sometimes disconnected fragments and images would surface years or even decades later. The neurologist called it a defense mechanism. Made sense to Lisi. From the hospital, she'd gone back to the motel where she was staying. It wasn't a very good room, in back, with nothing to look at but a board fence and nothing to listen to except 100 or so barking dogs. But she was far past caring about such things. Certainly, she wanted nothing to do with the campus where her husband had been shot. And as she kicked off her shoes and lay down on the hard double bed, she thought, "Darkness loves him." Was that true? How could she say when she didn't even know what it meant? You know, Daddy's prize was a kiss. Lisi had turned her head so swiftly on the pillow she might have been slapped by an invisible hand. Shut up about that. No answer. No answer. And then, slyly, "Darkness loves him. He dances with it like a lover, and the moon comes up over the purple hill, and what was sweet smells sour, smells like poison." She had turned her head back the other way. And outside the motel room, the dogs, every smucking dog in Nashville, it sounded like, had barked as the sun went down in orange August smoke, making a hole for the night. As a child, she had been told by her mother there was nothing to fear in the dark, and she had believed it to be true. She had been downright gleeful in the dark, even when it was lit by lightning and ripped by thunder. While her years-old sister Manda cowered under the covers, little Lisi sat atop her own bed, sucking her thumb and demanding that someone bring the flashlight and read her a story. She had told this to Scott once, and he had taken her hands and said, "You be my light, then. Be my light, Lisi." And she had tried, but... "I was in a dark place," Lisi murmured as she sat in his deserted study with the U-10 Nashville Review in her hands. "Did you say that, Scott? You did, didn't you? I was in a dark place, and you found me. You saved me." Maybe in Nashville that had been true, not in the end. You were always saving me, Lisi. Do you remember the first night I stayed at your apartment? Sitting here now with the book in her lap, Lisi smiled. Of course she did. Her strongest memory was of too much peppermint schnapps. It had given her an acidy stomach. And he'd had trouble first getting and then maintaining an erection, although in the end everything went all right. She'd assumed then it was the booze. It wasn't until later that he'd told her he'd never been successful until her. She'd been his first. She'd been his only. And every story he'd ever told her or anyone else about his crazy life of adolescent sex, both gay and straight, had been a lie. And Lisi? Lisi had seen him as an unfinished project, a thing to do before going to sleep. Coax the dishwasher through the noisy part of her cycle, set the Pyrex casserole dish to soak, blow the hotshot young writer until he gets some decent wood. When it was done and you went to sleep, I lay awake and listened to the clock on your nightstand and the wind outside, and understood that I was really home. That in bed with you was home. And something that had been getting close in the dark was suddenly gone. It could not stay. It had been banished. It knew how to come back, I was sure of that, but it could not stay. And I could really go to sleep. My heart cracked with gratitude. I think it was the first gratitude I've ever really known. I lay there beside you, and the tears rolled down the sides of my face and onto the pillow. I loved you then, and I love you now, and I have loved you every second in between. I don't care if you understand me. Understanding's vastly overrated, but nobody ever gets enough safety. I've never forgotten how safe I felt with that thing gone out of the darkness. Daddy's prize was a kiss. Lisi said it out loud this time, and although it was warm in the empty study, she shivered. She still didn't know what it meant, but she was pretty sure she remembered when Scott had told her that Daddy's prize was a kiss, that she had been his first, and nobody ever got enough safety. Just before they were married. She had given him all the safety she knew how to give, but it hadn't been enough. In the end, Scott's thing had come back for him anyway. That thing he had sometimes glimpsed in mirrors and water glasses. The thing with the vast piebald side. The long boy. Lisi looked around the study fearfully for just a moment and wondered if it was watching her now. 2. She opened the U10 Nashville 1988 review. The spine's crack was like a pistol shot. It made her cry out in surprise and drop the book. Then she laughed, a little shakily, it was true. Lisi, you nit. This time a folded piece of newsprint fell out, yellowing and brittle to the touch. What she unfolded was a grainy photograph, caption included, starring a fellow of perhaps 23 who looked much younger thanks to his expression of dazed shock. In his right hand he held a short-handled shovel with a silver scoop. Said scoop had been engraved with words that were unreadable in the photo, but Lisi remembered what they were. Commencement, Shipman Library. The young man was sort of, well, peering at this shovel, and Lisi knew not just by his face, but by the whole awkward this way and that way jut of his lanky body that he didn't have any idea what he was seeing. It could have been an artillery shell, a bonsai tree, a radiation detector, or a china pig with a slot in its back for spare silver. It could have been a wang-dang-doodle, a phylactery testifying to the pompatus of love, or a cloche hat made out of coyote skin. It could have been the penis of the poet Pindar. This guy was too far gone to know. Nor, she was willing to bet, was he aware that grasping his left hand, also frozen forever in swarms of black photo dots, was a man in what looked like a costume ball motor highway patrolman's uniform, no gun, but a Sam Brown belt running across the chest and what Scott, laughing and making big eyes, might have called a perfectly huge batch of orifice. He also had a perfectly huge grin on his face. The kind of relieved, oh, thank you God grin that said, son, you'll never have to buy yourself another drink in another bar where I happen to be, as long as I've got $1 to rub against another one. In the background, she could see Dashmeel, the little prig southerner who had run away. Roger C. Dashmeel, it came to her. The big C stands for chicken shit. Had she, little Lisi Landon, Seen the happy campus security cops shaking the dazed young man's hand? No, but Chillums, looky here. Do you want a true life image to equal such fairy tale visions as Alice falling down her rabbit hole or a toad in a top hat driving a motor car? Then check this out, over on the right side of the picture. Lisi bent down until her nose was almost touching the yellowed photo from the Nashville American. There was a magnifying glass in the wide center drawer of Scott's main desk. She had seen it on many occasions. Its place preserved between the world's oldest unopened package of Herbert Territon cigarettes and the world's oldest book of unredeemed S&H green stamps. She could have gotten it, but didn't bother. Didn't need any magnification to confirm what she was seeing. Half a brown loafer. Half a Cordovan loafer, actually, with a slightly built-up heel. She remembered those loafers very well. How comfortable they'd been. And she'd certainly moved in them that day, hadn't she? She hadn't seen the happy cop or the dazed young man. Tony, she was sure of. Tony here will be writing it up, fame. Nor had she noticed Dashmeal, the southern fried chicken shit, once the cheese hit the grater. All of them had ceased to matter to her, the whole smuckin' bunch of them. By then she had only one thing on her mind, and that had been Scott. He was surely no more than 10 feet away. But she had known that if she didn't get to him at once, the crowd around him would keep her out. And if she were kept out, the crowd might kill him. Kill him with its dangerous love and voracious concern. And what the smuck, Violet, he might have been dying anyway. If he was, she meant to be there when he stepped out. When he went, as the folks of her mother and father's generation would have said. I was sure he'd die, Lisi said to the silent, unwashed room, to the dusty, winding bulk of the book snake. So she'd run to her fallen husband and the news photographer, who'd been there only to snap the obligatory picture of college dignitaries and a famous visiting author gathered for the groundbreaking with the silver spade, the ritual first shovelful of earth where the new library would eventually stand, had ended up snapping a much more dynamic photograph, hadn't he? This was a front-page photo, maybe even a Hall of Fame photo, the kind that made you pause with a spoonful of breakfast cereal halfway between the bowl and your mouth, dripping on the classifieds, like the photo of Oswald, with his hands to his belly and his mouth open in a final dying yawp, the kind of frozen image you never forgot. Only Lisi herself would ever realize that the writer's wife was also in the photo, exactly one built-up heel of her. The caption running along the bottom of the photo read, Captain S. Heffernan of U-10 Campus Security congratulates Tony Eddington, who saved the life of famous visiting author Scott Landon only seconds before this photo was taken. He's an authentic hero, said Captain Heffernan. No one else was close enough to take a hand. Additional coverage, page 4, page 9. Running up the left-hand side was a fairly lengthy message in handwriting she didn't recognize. Running up the right-hand side were two lines of Scott's sprawly handwriting, the first line slightly larger than the second. And a little arrow, by God, pointing to the shoe. She knew what the arrow meant. He had recognized it for what it was. Coupled with his wife's story, call it Lisi and the Madman, a thrilling tale of true adventure, he had understood everything. And was he furious? No, because he had known his wife would not be furious. He had known she'd think it was funny, and it was funny. A smucking riot. So why was she on the verge of crying? Never in her whole life had she been so surprised, tricked, and over-trumped by her emotions as in these last few days. Lisi dropped the news clipping on top of the book, afraid a sudden flood of tears might actually dissolve it the way saliva dissolves a mouthful of cotton candy. She cupped her hands over her eyes and waited. When she was sure the tears weren't going to overflow, she picked up the clipping and read what Scott had written. Must show to Lisi how she will laugh. But will she understand? Our survey says yes. He had turned the big exclamation point at the end of the note into a sunny 70s-style smiley face, as if telling her to have a nice day. And Lisi did understand. 18 years late, but so what? Memory was relative. Very zen, Grasshopper, Scott might have said. Zen Schmen, I wonder how Tony's doing these days, that's what I wonder. Savior of the famous Scott Landon. She laughed, and the tears that had still been standing in her eyes spilled down her cheeks. Now she turned the photo Wittershins and read the other, longer note. 8-18-88.
Dear Scott, if I may, I thought you would want to see this photograph of C. Anthony, Tony, Eddington III, the young grad student who saved your life. U-10 will be honoring him, of course. We felt you might also want to be in touch. His address is 748 Coalview Avenue, Nashville North, Nashville, Tennessee, 37235. Mr. Eddington, poor but proud, comes from a fine southern Tennessee family and is an excellent student poet. You will, of course, want to thank, and perhaps reward, him in your own way. Respectfully, sir, I remain Roger C. Dashmill, Associate Professor, English Department, University of Tennessee, Nashville.
Lisi read this over once, twice, three times a lady, Scott would have sung at this point, still smiling, but now with a sour combination of amazement and final comprehension. Roger Dashmill was probably as ignorant of what had actually happened as the campus cop, which meant there were only two people in the whole round world who knew the truth about that afternoon. Lisi Landon and Tony Eddington, the fellow who would be rotting it up for the year-end review. It was possible that even Tona himself didn't realize what had happened after the ceremonial first spadeful of earth had been turned. Maybe he'd been in a fear-injected blackout. Dig it, he might really believe he had saved Scott Landon from death. No, she didn't think so. What she thought was that this clipping and the jotted, fulsome note were Dashmill's petty revenge on Scott for what? For just being polite? For looking at Monsieur de Literature Dashmill and not seeing him? For being a rich, creative snotbucket who was going to make a $15,000 payday for saying a few uplifting words and turning a single spadeful of earth? Pre-loosened earth at that? All those things, and more. Lisi thought Dashmill had somehow believed their positions would have been reversed in a truer, fairer world. That he, Roger Dashmill, would have been the focus of the intellectual interest and student adulation, while Scott Landon, not to mention his mousy little wooden fart of her life dependent on it wife, would be the ones toiling in the campus vineyards, always currying favor, testing the winds of departmental politics, and scurrying to make that next pay grade. Whatever it was, he didn't like Scott, and this was his revenge, she marveled to the empty, sunny rooms above the long barn. This poisoned pen clipping. She considered the idea for a moment, then burst out into gales of merry laughter, clapping her hands on the flat part of her chest above her breasts. When she recovered a little, she paged through the review until she found the article she was looking for. America's Most Famous Novelist Inaugurates Long-Held Library Dream. The byline was by Anthony Eddington, sometimes known as Tone. And, as Lisi skimmed it, she found she was capable of anger after all. Even rage. For there was no mention of how the day's festivities had ended, or the review author's own putative heroism, for that matter. The only suggestion that something had gone crazily wrong was in the concluding lines, Mr. Landon's speech following the groundbreaking and his reading in the student lounge that evening were canceled due to unexpected developments, but we hope to see this giant of American literature back on our campus soon. Perhaps for the ceremonial ribbon-cutting when the Shipman opens its doors in 1991. Reminding herself that this was the school review, for God's sake, a glossy, expensive hardcover book mailed out to presumably loaded alumni, went some distance toward diffusing her anger. Did she really think the U-10 review was going to let their hired hack rehash that day's bloody bit of slapstick? How many alumni dollars would that add to the coffers? Reminding herself that Scott would also have found this amusing helped. But not all that much. Scott, after all, wasn't here to put his arm around her, to kiss her cheek. to distract her by gently tweaking the tip of one breast and telling her that to everything there was a season, a time to sow, a time to reap, a time to strap, and likewise one to unstrap, yea, verily. Scott, damn him, was gone. And he bled for you people, she murmured in a resentful voice that sounded spookily like Manda's. He almost died for you people. Sort of a blue-eyed miracle he didn't. And Scott spoke to her again, as he had a way of doing. She knew it was only the ventriloquist inside her making his voice. Who had loved it more or remembered it better? But it didn't feel that way. It felt like him. You were my miracle, Scott said. You were my blue-eyed miracle. Not just that day, but always. You were the one who kept the dark away, Lisi. You shone. I suppose there were times when you thought so, she said absently.
Hot, wasn't it?
Yes, it had been hot. But not just hot. It was humid, Lisi said, muggy. And I had a bad feeling about it from the get-go. Sitting in front of the book snake, with the U10 Nashville 1998 review lying open on her lap, Lisi had a momentary but brilliant glimpse of Granny Dee feeding the chickens way back when on the home place. It was in the bathroom that I started to feel really bad, because I broke... 3. She keeps thinking about the glass, that smucking broken glass. When, that is, she's not thinking of how much she'd like to get out of this heat. Lisi stands behind and slightly to Scott's right, with her hands clasped demurely before her, watching him balance on one foot, the other on the shoulder of the silly little shovel half buried in loose earth that has clearly been brought in for the occasion. The day is maddeningly hot, maddeningly humid, maddeningly muggy, and the considerable crowd that has gathered only makes it worse. Unlike the dignitaries, the looky-loos aren't dressed in anything approaching their best, and while their jeans and shorts and pedal pushers may not exactly make them comfortable in the wet blanket air, Lisi envies them just the same as she stands here at the crowd's forefront, basting in the suck-oven heat of the Tennessee afternoon. Just standing pat, dressed up in her hot-weather best, is stressful. Worrying that she'll soon be sweating dark circles in the light brown linen top she's wearing over the blue rayon shell beneath, she's got on a great bra for hot weather, and still it's biting into the undersides of her boobs like nobody's business. Happy days, baby love. Scott, meanwhile, continues balancing on one foot while his hair, too long in back. He needs it cut badly. She knows he looks in the mirror and sees a rock star, but she looks at him and sees a smuckin' hobo out of a Woody Guthrie song. Blows in the occasional puff of hot breeze. He's being a good sport while the photographer circles. Damn good sport. He's flanked on the left by a guy named Tony Eddington, who's going to write up all this happy-crappy for some campus outlet or another, and on the right by their stand-in host, an English department stalwart named Roger Dashmeal. Dashmeal is one of those men who seem older than they are, not only because they have lost so much of their hair and gained so much belly, but because they insist upon drawing an almost stifling gravitas around themselves. Even their witticisms felt to Lisi like oral readings of insurance policy clauses. Making matters worse is the fact that Dashmeal doesn't like her husband. Lisi has sensed this at once. It's easy, because most men do like him. And it has given her something upon which to focus her unease. For she is uneasy. Profoundly so. She has tried to tell herself that it's no more than the humidity and the gathering clouds in the west, presaging strong afternoon thunderstorms, or maybe even tornadoes. A low barometer kind of thing. But the barometer wasn't low in Maine when she got out of bed this morning at 6:45. It had been a beautiful summer morning already, with the newly risen sun sparkling on a trillion points of dew in the grass between the house and Scott's study. Not a cloud in the sky. What old dandy Dave DeBuscher would have called a real ham and egger of a day. Yet the instant her feet touched the oak boards of the bedroom floor and her thoughts turned to the trip to Nashville, leave for the Portland jetport at 8, fly out on Delta at 9:40. Her heart dipped with dread, and her morning empty stomach, usually sweet, foamed with unmotivated fear. She had greeted these sensations with surprised dismay, because she ordinarily liked to travel, especially with Scott. The two of them sitting companionably side by side, he with his book open, she with hers. Sometimes he'd read her a little bit of his, and sometimes she'd vice him a little versa. Sometimes she'd feel him and look up and find his eyes, his solemn regard, as though she were a mystery to him still. Yes, and sometimes there would be turbulence.